All right. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Welcome to VUX World. I'm back for after what feels like 7 weeks of just having my head on a pillow, not being able to get up. You can probably still hear a little bit of my voice is still not quite back. I've been, not in a good space for the last week. It hasn't been COVID, thankfully. I say thankfully. I don't know what the difference would have been like if it was COVID, because it completely wiped me out for a good few days. But anyway, we're back. Here we are, fighting fit, and we're back for another epic episode of the VUX World Podcast. Before I do bring on today's guests, obviously I need to tell you about Unparsed. There'll be some announcements happening this week on the Unparsed front, which is immensely exciting. We've got a new wave of speakers announced. In fact, we've pretty much filled up all of the speaker slots. We've had far more applications than we can realistically put on the agenda. We're trying to still reserve some spots, because inevitably what's going to happen between now and then is there's going to be some really interesting talks that come up again. So we're trying not to absolutely fill absolutely everything right now. However, we have decided that because we've had so much epic content submitted, we are going to put another day of programming on that first day. So the day one was going to be workshops and hackathon. It's now going to be workshops, hackathon, and more content. Excuse me, I'm going to have to cough. I told you I'm not exactly spot on right now. So anyway, the first day is going to be workshops, hackathon, and more content. Day two is going to be, again, content, keynotes, interactive content as well. We've got a whole space full for interactive content. Again, there's the design track, the developer track. We've got speakers from Booking.com, Lloyds Banking Group, Hugging Face, Samsung, Just Answer, you name it. There's some incredible brands speaking, and also some incredible individuals, and also some incredible, I would suppose, what would you call them, personalities. The who is who of the conversational AI scene will be there. And so look out for those announcements. The early birds offer was going to end basically pretty much now. We're extending it by 2 weeks because of the fact that we're just publishing the agenda and we're just publishing a new wave of speakers. So we're going to give people another chance to get hold of those early bird tickets. So early birds tickets will be available until the end of March. The agenda will be published this week. More speakers are announced this week. You can go to unparsed.com to find out more and get your pass, which I'm sure you will do as soon as you've finished listening to this amazing conversation that we're about to get into right now with Amelia. We've got Brandon Knott, who's the CPO of Amelia, and Nick Orlando, Director of Product at Amelia, joining me on the podcast right now. Nick and Brandon, welcome to VUX World.
What's up, Kane? It's good to be here.
Nice to have you. You haven't been on a podcast before. We've done lots of webinars and stuff together. I don't think you've been on a podcast before, have you?
Yeah, I think this is my first podcast with you, but yeah, no stranger to webinars and in the VUX world.
Nice, nice. And Brandon, welcome. Welcome to the podcast for the first time.
Thank you. Thank you for having us today.
No worries. No worries. I'm going to change this view here a little bit because it looks a bit messy with Zoom. But thanks for joining me. Thank you very much for joining me. Amelia has been in this space for a long time. It's one of the kind of OGs, if you like, of this conversational AI space. You know, if you think about the, I don't know, you might think about the live persons, you might think about the creative virtuals and those kind of companies who were around before conversational AI was conversational AI, and Amelia when it was IPsoft. Interesting fact, don't know if you know this, Brandon, but Jeff Smith Jr. was one of the AI engineers at IPsoft way back when, and he was the third guest on the VUX World podcast ever. So Amelia's roots go back to the very, very beginning of VUX World. How's that?
That's amazing.
It's cool, that, isn't it? So when did it change from IPsoft to Amelia officially? Because Amelia was originally the avatar, wasn't it?
That's right. It's been a progression, and not so much a hard cutover. Amelia very much, and IPsoft has roots in managed services and looking at doing amazing things for companies when it comes to the automation and orchestration of their backend systems. Along that journey, voice started coming on the scene, and at first, voice was an add-on to that service. So it was a different way to interact with those automation capabilities. And as you've seen from the market, voice has really become the new interface, right? It's a whole new paradigm And so that voice element started getting more and more interesting. And as more capabilities went into that, you could see the shift, the momentum shift within the company towards these voice solutions, right? Conversational AI, alongside these classic automation principles around backend automation and then expanding into different channels into different systems for automation purposes.
Right. So the genesis of Amelia then, as far as getting into conversational AI, was mainly on because of the voice capabilities.
That's right. That's right. Which I think is actually a powerful statement, because what it says is that voice came on not as a fad or a trend or something that's just exciting, but not adding value. It came on out of necessity, right? And then as, you know, we'll talk about generative AI has hit the scene in a real meaningful way, only somewhat recently, it's fueled a whole new, thing of stages of a rocket, right? You have a whole new stage of boost that's happening to accelerate this industry.
Interesting. I wasn't aware that Amelia was a real early adopter of voice. I thought it was predominantly the kind of avatar alongside the web chat that was the sort of main kind of USP, I suppose, in like 2017 or so. So was it voice as in contact center voice? Was it voice as in, you know, voice enabling devices and stuff like that? Because obviously Alexa was taken off and stuff like that around about 2016, 2017. Like which was it, or was it both?
Yeah, so underneath the channel, as we call it, right? Channels include Microsoft Teams, SMS chat, integrated chat into an interface, phone, voice, right? Underneath that is the engine, is the chat engine, and Amelia's brain, as we say. And the brain is really where the magic happens. That's where the IP is. How do you use different subsystems in order to take an utterance or take an input and make sense of it, and then direct the user down a path? So we think a little bit less about voice or text or whatever the case may be. We think about the utterance coming in through any channel, through maybe even different languages, right? And how the engine processes that and uses the best technology and the best subsystem or the best method in order to guide the user to a productive next step. That's the real power. That's where the Amelia focus has been.
Fair enough. And so lots of companies have different ways of approaching this whole idea of understanding language. And I know you mentioned that we will get into generative AI and how Amelia is approaching generative AI, and whether generative AI means that some of the potential, I suppose, USPs or positioning gains that platforms may have had in the past might change. Because if you think about, you know, I want to say a company like iGo, or a company like Poly AI or Action AI, like these are companies who, you know, they're not using the traditional speakeasy. Is also a good reference, although it's been acquired by Verint. Soundhound's another one, actually. These are companies that are not using the kind of traditional NLU models as we all know and love them. They're all using some kind of, you know, different concept. Whereas iGo is using a model of a representation of the human brain, for example, to be able to understand. Action AI is using kind of advanced semantic understanding. Poly AI is using, you know, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's some kind of research out of Cambridge University that they've kind of built around. Speakeasy and Soundhound were both doing something fairly similar, where they were using, rather than speech recognition, they were kind of using speech to intent, and then an NLU model that was running in parallel with a speech recognition system to predict what people were saying rather than simply understand it. So there's lots of the kind of platforms that have had some sort of unique approach to trying to do language understanding in the past. Amelia and the brain that you just described, how is that functioning? Is that something similar to those companies I mentioned? Is like a USP enables you to understand better and perform better? And if so, how?
Yeah, great question. And I love the lead in too. So you mentioned something that I'll build on top of. You mentioned taking the human brain and using that as a pattern, right? So Amelia works in a similar way. If you are developing within Amelia, you can open up a window that shows you how Amelia is going to process a given utterance. And there's about two dozen different subsystems in there. One of them is looking for a sentiment. Are you angry? Are you frustrated? And based on that, Amelia may route you in a different direction. Amelia may point you towards an agent. There's a BPN or a deterministic process subsystem that's looking to match what you're saying to existing processes that have 100% chance of essentially guiding you to the outcome that you're looking for because you're on those rails. It has a generative subsystem that's looking at, is there any documentation that the user has uploaded that might be interesting to answer the question you have or respond to the utterance? So think about these subsystems as competing with each other for the right, the benefit to answer the user, right? And when you have that, the diversity of the subsystems, it does two really interesting things for you. The first is it makes the conversation dynamic. It gives you different optionality and allows you to have a broader implementation that the user can interact with, increasing the chance of a favorable NPS or score associated with that conversation. The second thing it does, and this is really important, it provides a built-in layer of extensibility, meaning the next cool model that comes in and offers a different flavor of conversation, or the next method provided maybe by a partner that comes in and allows Amelia to tap directly into their systems and integrate it into that conversational framework, it gives our customers the chance to have a platform and to easily plug in new technologies and new integrations at you know, human level, right? In a deep way, and part of your brain that you don't even think about, you just respond, right? It's like the Matrix when you download a whole new skill and you have it, right? Same sort of thing. You plug in that subsystem, Amelia has it, and that those conversations can then leverage it to provide the user the type of answer, the type of outcome that they're looking for.
Mm. Does that mean then that, so if you think about a few of those companies I mentioned and others, some companies are kind of positioning themselves as our platform, our kind of toolkit is the best toolkit, right? Obviously, everyone's going to say that anyway, but like, you know, we have the best models, we have the best approach to dialogue management, we have the best approach to integration, we have the best approach to channel management, we can do absolutely everything, use us. Whereas other companies are starting to move more towards that kind of, hey, our real value is the orchestration. We orchestrate together all of these different models, all of these different products, and so we don't care whether you've got your own model, Mr. or Mrs. Brand, or you've got your, you know, your own sort of way of doing things. We are going to help you orchestrate your entire customer experience. Would you put yourself in the kind of former camp, which is we do things our way and it's absolutely really, really good? It sounds as though from your last answer that you're more leaning towards the latter, which is becoming more of an orchestration platform. Am I on the right lines or no?
Yeah, and I'd love to get Nick's thoughts on this well, but the my short answer is we think that this space is evolving so quickly. There are new foundation models coming out, you know, weekly, you know, it was daily for a little bit there. We're seeing the rise of small models, vertical specific models. I think it's anyone should be cautious right now to base a solution on a single model or a single method or methodology for having conversation. We think that customers are learning at an extremely rapid pace when it comes to generative AI and learning what works for them, what models are interesting to them. They're bringing requirements to us. And so we really want to take an agnostic approach when it comes to foundation models. And even, you know, generative is not always the best way to do something. Sometimes a smaller model, an alternative model, even an older model by modern definition of age, right? May only be a few years old, might be more efficient, might be the better solution. So being able to partner where appropriate, develop our own solutions where appropriate, provide customers with the optionality all within an existing framework, an existing platform, we feel strongly that's what's going to enable customers to have the best outcomes for themselves and their customers.
Absolutely. Maybe it's a good time to bring you in, Nick. I know you've been doing a lot of work and research with large language models and stuff like that. What I mentioned before in terms of, you know, the kind of positioning of these AI technologies, lots of companies in the last sort of like decade or so, they've had to find ways of positioning themselves, find ways of standing out from the crowd and stuff like that. And, you know, our way of doing it is a better way than XYZ, and here's why. And it was a time when I remember must have been 2018, perhaps, maybe it's even 2019, where companies, I'm not saying Amelia specifically, but certainly your competitors were competing on things like NLU accuracy. Our NLU is a better NLU than any other NLU, and so use our NLU kind of thing. Whereas now with generative AI, kind of everyone has access to the same models. Everyone has access to the same research that's happening. Not everybody, I don't think, has figured out exactly how to leverage them properly, how to integrate them into a platform like Amelia's properly. But still, the raw capabilities are available to everyone. So how does that new capability, that new sort of power, change the way that you think about the product and also its potential differentiation?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. And I think that brings up, there's two things that come to mind initially when you say that. One is kind of like, what is generative AI's role in the stack, right? And number two is, what is the market generally doing? Very quickly on what the market is doing, I think you see a lot of people chasing the shiny object. And this has been fairly common in this space for a long time. But a lot of people chase the shiny object. What is the newest, shiniest thing that everybody's talking about in the news, everybody's talking about in the media? And how can I incorporate that into my system, into my platform? How can I offer that with its perceived value, even if that value isn't real? Where Amelia differentiates, one of the many ways that we differentiate, is making sure that we actually understand how that piece is going to derive true value for our customers. We don't want to add something to our platform just because everybody's talking about it. We want to add something to our platform because it's going to drive true value to our customers. Which brings me back to, how do we see generative AI? It's a component of a system, right? I think what a lot of people did when ChatGPT came out and when LLMs first came onto the scene is, and I've had conversations like this at many conferences. Oh, GPT-4, it's the best model out there. That's all you need to use. It'll do everything. And it's like, well, like, no, it won't. GPT-4 isn't going to maintain context across a state. GPT-4 isn't going to take action, right? There are a lot of things that it cannot do inherently out of the box, which is why the LLMs in generative AI is amazing. It's phenomenal because it has, to your earlier point, we're not going to be talking about, oh, who has the highest NLU accuracy. If you can use an LLM for intent recognition and you're getting consistently in the high 90s of intent recognition, you don't need to train a black box, you know, BILSTM anymore. So now what you can do is you can abstract to a higher level where you're interacting with the technology in natural language, which is what this conversational AI market is all about. So we really look at generative AI as playing a part in a larger system, but that system needs to be a combination of deterministic tools where you have reliability, predictability. You know that something is going to happen the same way 100% of the time, because in an enterprise, you need to check your bank account balance the same way every time. You need to report fraud the same way every time. You can't leave that up to a probabilistic model. However, there are certain things that LLMs are amazing at. that they are a step function above anything else that exists today. So for those things, we should absolutely use generative AI. And I think that that's what, how Amelia has really been seeing this is, what is the best combination of generative AI and conversational AI? How can we weave them together in a way that optimizes your costs, optimizes your outcomes, optimizes performance, all of the above, so that we can, again, go back to the true value that we're deriving for our customers.
Mm. Do you see, do you treat those two things as distinctly different than when you said generative AI and conversational AI? Because I'm seeing that a lot, which is, you know, conferences, for example, are being called the conversational and generative AI event. And even at Unpars, we kind of, we drop conversational AI in there because we want to make sure people understand that we're going to be talking about conversational interfaces, but we also drop generative AI in there in case it's lost in translation. But for me, it's all conversational AI because it's all language in, language out, or at least language in and action out. So I think, do you see a distinct difference between generative AI and conversational AI? Is generative AI part of conversational AI or vice versa or what?
I think so. Yes. I think that, that's a really interesting question too, because it brings up some of the capabilities that generative AI has that's outside of conversational AI. So I think that if I were to draw a Venn diagram, for example, like there would be a big conversational AI circle, and then there would be a smaller generative AI circle that has maybe 50 or 60, 75% of it inside conversational AI, and then maybe 25% or so outside of conversational AI. Because when you're getting into, you know, voice to image generation, to video generation, things like that, I would, you know, I would exclude that from this market at this point in time. You know, how I've always seen conversational AI is, how can you interact with a machine or a system or a piece of technology in natural language, whether it's a chat or whether it's voice, doesn't matter. How can I interact with something in natural language? And I think that generative AI is a subset of that because, again, it can do, it's great at understanding language. It's great at generating language. It's great at summarizing a large corpus of data. It's great at retrieving certain pieces of information from that corpus of data. So there are distinct problem sets that generative AI can solve for at a very high level of efficacy. But then I would also, under the conversational AI umbrella, I'd also include automation, right? Like there's this whole world of automation that conversational AI may be a front end for, but quite frankly, the most valuable conversational AI use cases are the ones where some sort of action happens, right? Where you understand what a user wants to do, and then the agent, the virtual agent, is actually able to go into the backend systems and execute whatever transaction needed to be done. And I think that what's interesting about generative AI is that now they've come up with a cool name for that, large action model, right? Which is very deceptive because there's no research paper that's been written about large action models. It's not a separate model. What it really is it's combining large language models with deterministic approaches, neurosymbiotic approaches to AI so that you can drive action on the back end, which is something that Amelia has been doing for a decade now. We just didn't have a fancy name for it called large action model. So I think it's a really interesting question for where the lines are drawn of conversational and generative AI. But I absolutely believe that they're kind of, you know, they're very much parallel topics and there's a lot of overlap between them. But I'm cautious to just go with generative or just go with conversational, because you want to make sure that you're not misrepresenting yourself or doing a disservice to yourself as well.
Yeah, 100%. And you're struggling on the head, which is that some things like checking a bank balance need to be the same every time. There's no reason why that needs to change, you know, and this is very similar for many business processes. When you get down to like the action-oriented, you know, abilities of assistants or agents or whatever you want to call them, you have to have the balance of the two things, which is the knowing and doing, isn't it? They have to know stuff, which is, I think, a lot of where the attention has been placed on generative AI recently, you know, with RAG and stuff like that. Like, that gives chatbots the ability to know stuff and understand the breadth of conversation, which, you know, the traditional NLU models were not great at doing. But then when it comes to doing stuff, that's the stuff that's not really going to change. That does require a very, very specific process to be followed in order to action. It doesn't necessarily mean that that process is a good process. I mean, that's what I'm finding a lot, is that a lot of businesses that want to use AI for their sort of like customer experience automation, they're what I call putting lipstick on a pig, which is that the back end processes are ugly, but they want to just stick a nice fancy conversational interface on top of it, you know? So those areas where you're having stuff, having the assistant do stuff, I think the balance between the two, deterministic and generative, might be helpful. Generative to help with the understanding, but deterministic to follow the process. And for those use cases where it's more about knowing, you're probably more in a place where the generative models can find their feet a little bit more. I don't know whether that's kind of the way you've been thinking about it, Nick and Brandon, whether you want to share a little bit on how you see the blending of those two technologies coming together and how.
Yeah, I think blending is a great word to use, and it's a great kind of mental model to have when you're thinking about generative. And you know, now we're adding different ways to talk about the AI that already exists. Some people are snapping to classic AI, right? Which is ironic because it's not that long ago that some of these things were pretty critical. You know, the other thing is, Generative AI is actually older than people think it is, right? Millie was using our first Gen AI model in 2020 as one of those subsystems. It wasn't until just, you know, a year and a half ago when the size and the capability of the model all of a sudden made it, you know, have superpowers, right? Rather than, you know, just gray powers. But Nick and I talk about this. In fact, we were just talking about, you know, the best way to think about generative and classic AI, or you know, the those more deterministic approaches, right? What's the best way to talk about it? Because it's easy to miss something in nuance and to make it sound like you're saying generative isn't awesome, or generative no is not the answer, right? And that couldn't be further from the truth in terms of how we think about it. We think about it as, it is total, generative is awesome. Generative is capable of so many things, and it's not going to slow down. You know, if you look at generative by any measure of technology, it's one of the most successful, you know, categories of technology ever. But it works best in concert, with other systems, right? Other things, whether it's actioning or like Nick said, you know, when we talk to customers, they want Gen AI, they want to see the capabilities, they want to see the roadmap. We start to implement, we say, what's your first use case? And almost, you know, 9 times out of 10, the first use case is something that has to go right every single time because there's regulatory pressure or compliance issues or financial risk associated with it, right? So it becomes really critical then to find the right scope of generative AI capability in the context of a use case, in the context of a scenario. Therefore, holding generative and platform capabilities together in kind of an equal share of the conversation becomes really important, because people need to understand what tools they have to get the job done, and then pick the right components of the platform in order to meet the needs of their business.
Do you think that, it'd be interesting to get both of your thoughts on this, like, do you think that the inevitable interest in generative AI is actually just an interest in kind of automation? You know, like, because you've got the question of, like, you know, you keep hearing about, like, the CEO saying, hey, right, what we're doing about ChatGPT and what we're doing about AI and all that kind of stuff. And as you've kind of described there, a client comes to you, and their first priority use case is something that's very deterministic. Now, you can solve that need, and you can have them tick the AI box, but you don't have to use generative AI necessarily. There's lots of other AI that you could use for that. Even NLU is a form of AI that can be used in that situation. So like what the market believes it wants is this nice flashy generative AI story. What they actually really need is some good old fashioned NLU, some process automation, and kind of like results, you know what I mean? So I just wonder whether, like, you know, the demand has been created because of generative AI, but the actual, the thing that's going to solve that demand, or at least the solution, isn't always the case. So would you concur with that? Like, would you think that this is a almost like a pseudo interest in generative AI, where the real interest, when you get down to it, is actually that it's more interest in you know, good old fashioned automation?
Maybe I can throw a quick answer, and then Nick is you know, I think better at me than in going through this. So permit me the detour. I'm a gearhead. I love cars. I really love cars. And if you look at carbon fiber got introduced and people went nuts, right? I need carbon fiber. I need, you know, race cars were creating entire bodies out of carbon fiber. High-end luxury cars are putting carbon fiber on the panels, right? Why? Well, it's lighter, it's stronger, you go faster. Maybe, right? That is a part of the broader system. And it's a very important part. And we think about generative AI, I actually think about it like carbon fiber. It's awesome. It's strong. It's capable. But where you use it makes all the difference. So in that deterministic use case that you talk about that a customer needs, we can use generative to write the code for that use case. Right. And then deploy that code. So we do that today in Amelia Builds Amelia. We can use generative as part of that intent recognition. You talked about NLU models, right? There are very low risk, highly effective ways to use generative, even to get to that deterministic checkpoint. And then on the other side of that, you can use generative directly in RAG models, where we're seeing so many startups and so many companies embracing the idea of using RAG to bolster their ability to communicate to their customers by taking their information and essentially being able to have a conversation with it. So I see generative as more of a spectrum about how you use it and where you use it in the process. But at the end of the day, like you say, there are use cases that benefit from deterministic code. And there are use cases that are okay to be more probabilistic, really front facing. And you just make sure that you put the appropriate controls around them.
I like that analogy. I like the carbon fiber analogy. That's really good. What do you think, Nick?
Yeah, I would echo what Brandon just said. What I would add to that, though, is, you know, I do believe that there's a lot of confusion in the market, right? I think that generative AI brought in a lot of confusion, where executives saw something that really, you know, in conversational AI, we talk about experience a lot, right? Creating delightful experiences, creating phenomenal user experiences. And then when you saw a lot of the, you know, chatbots that were deployed in the late teens and early, you know, 2020s, a lot of them didn't really live up to the expectation. There was, you know, this talk of a delightful experience. And then you would get on the phone with, you know, an airline or a bank, and it would break. And the same chat body, like, awful experience would happen over and over again. And I think that created a bit of I think that people, including executives, became a little bit disappointed or underwhelmed with where the technology was. So I do believe that ChatGPT lit the fire again, where it's like, holy cow, this is that delightful experience that people have been talking about. But what's funny is that the reality is that ChatGPT or an LLM can handle a certain amount of, you know, use cases, like FAQs using a RAG system. But to get to your true value, you really want to be able to drive automation of transactional use cases. So you need to have something that is really more classical, but you kind of want to have a shiny, I don't even want to call it shiny because that's a negative word in some ways, but you want to have a really delightful experience around how you interact with that automation process. So I absolutely think that executives are really looking for automation, but also something that works when it talks to your users. And one way that I think about this, right, is if I'm going to a concert, right, and I'm going to a concert, generally speaking, most concerts that you go to are completely scripted. You know what's going to happen end to end. You could attribute this to kind of a deterministic process. And that doesn't make the concert boring, but it might not make it quite as exciting. It might not give it quite the same feel, right? But then if you add in jazz to that concert, right? Jazz, something that's completely improvised, something that's completely going based off the feel of what's going on in the moment. And now you have this combination of something that provides that classical, you know, it's going to hit home. You know, it's going to do a good job. You know, the crowd's going to like it, but now you add in this element of surprise and you add in this element of delight. Now you have something that's completely new and really kind of transports you into the future of how people could interact with music in that world. But for me, how you could interact with technology in the future of our world. So I think that that's what generative AI is offering, is it's now delivering on the promise of the delightful experience, but ultimately we still need to deliver on the value of process automation. So I think that that's one way that I like to think about it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And how is it that Amelia utilizes generative AI then? So, you know, there's loads of use cases in terms of how you could integrate that into the platform, from the design side of things. You know, I've seen platforms where you just describe the conversation you want to have and then up pops a version of that conversation happening in the tool. There's use cases around, you know, creating training data for, you know, typical kind of traditional NLU intents. There's getting rid of intents entirely and using it to, you know, classify what people are saying based on certain topics. Obviously, you've got the RAG implementation where you can ingest some knowledge and have that surface that knowledge either as it is or summarize it and generate content off the back of it. There's a whole bunch of capabilities around agent assist, around summarization and disposition code generation, things like that. So, you know, there's lots of use cases out there. I'm assuming you've probably tackled everything I've already kind of mentioned. Is there anything sort of like any way that Amelia is approaching things differently as far as how you're thinking about generative AI and how you've integrated it into the platform?
Yeah, great question. And you're right. There's half a dozen different ways or so that generative is leveraged. Some of them very much behind the scenes and integrated right into the system. And so it's not really obvious as a user that generative is the engine writing that code, for instance, right? Unless you understand the techniques. And in other ways, like RAG, it's much more upfront, right? It's obvious. And you're even, as a conversational designer, you're specifying and setting and tuning, right? Here's my minimum threshold for a response, right? So that tuning becomes a really important part of how you build the solution. What I would say in terms of, you know, differentiation or different approach, there's a couple parts to that. So there's the use case, and then there's the underlying bits that go in to fulfill the use case. So there are a number of frameworks available for RAG, let's say, that you can take off the shelf. And what you tend to find is the frameworks are awesome for getting started. And then before too much time, you have to start swapping out parts of that framework, if not the entire framework, for your own code in order to dial in and get more specific or more scalable or whatever the case may be. The same is true for your prompts, right? Prompt engineering, while I'm not sure that it'll be a job unto itself, it's 100% a thing, right? You must be a good prompt engineer. You must know how to write prompts well in order to get the most out of a model. How you do that behind the scenes and what you expose to the user to allow a user to actually do their, some customization there is really critical. Think about the tuning and grounding of models, right? Now we're getting really specific to a line of business within a company, within a region, whatever the case may be, or we're supplementing the models with additional information from that customer in order to help direct it and narrow down the responses. So the methodologies behind these use cases go very deep. And when you think about differentiation and competitive advantage, there is the breadth of the use case, but there's also the depth of implementation associated with that to make sure that you're getting high you know, intent matching, low risk of hallucination, right? And that the both the customer and the user understand what the you know, acceptable level of variation, let's call it, or hallucination is with that use case. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. Yeah. And earlier on, you mentioned that customers kind of bring you use cases, if you like. And you mentioned that, you know, there's the kind of idea of starting where things are a little bit less risky, easier to manage, things like that. Maybe we can start there. And if you could give us some examples of some things that maybe customers or potential prospects have kind of brought to you, which is how can we leverage generative AI in a low risk environment? And then after that, I want to get into some of the high risk stuff, because I think that could be an exciting conversation to have. But firstly, let's go where, what are some of the examples where clients have come to you and said, we want to get started with generative AI, we don't have a huge risk appetite, what can we do?
Yeah, great question. I think the most common starting point right now are two things. One, summarizing information. This happens a lot on agent calls, or taking a look at transcripts and summarizing them for another purpose. Pretty low risk, because it's an internal employee that's going to be the beneficiary of that output, right? And they can apply their human filter on top of it. So anytime you're using generative, which is then going to go to a human to make a judgment or to act on, you inherently have a safety net built, right? And then we kind of shift up a little bit to a RAG model, where an employee for a horizontal use case like HR or IT service desk, right? I can ask my company chatbot, you know, what's my vacation policy? And it's gonna look at the whole corpus of company information and provide back to me that answer, even if it's different for me than it is for Nick, because maybe we live in different countries and there's different policies associated with that, right? The RAG model is capable of understanding that differentiation. Where it starts let's also say using generative to write code, awesome. Again, a human's going to look at that, or even if somehow they weren't, you're still going to have checks and balances in your DevOps process and things like that are going to have gates along the way.
You mentioned that a few times, using generative to write code. What's an example in the Amelia platform where an end user might have Amelia generative AI generate some code?
So great question. So one of the features we have is to simply be able to ask Amelia directly. Amelia, as a call center agent, I want to be able to troubleshoot a given use case that's coming in. You know, write me the code to do that, and Amelia will build out that flow using generative, and then as a developer, I get to go in and customize that to my process.
All right. So I would tell Amelia what it is I'm trying to accomplish.
That's right.
Amelia will take that prompt, and then behind the scenes, the Amelia platform will generate the code in its own platform to provide you a solution. Is that my understanding correct? Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then I'll go in and tweak it, and then it can be deployed.
Yeah.
Right. To take a look at a slightly, you know, different iteration of that. Maybe I already know my process. Maybe I already have it very well documented, and I actually want to upload my my process documentation. Amelia can also go through that and through Generative build out the solution.
Nice.
So very low risk because I have got that human and those process stage gates afterwards in order to deploy. And once it's deployed, it runs the same way every single time. You get the benefit of that deterministic model or approach, right? Mm-hmm. On the other side, you've got the whole RAG approach, which is a very common way for companies to be getting into conversational AI right now. Generative AI. That's a low hanging fruit approach. The important thing there is simply to manage the risk of hallucination, to have the appropriate checks and balances, both in the process about how the solution gives an answer, and at the end, making sure that there's an appropriate expectation set with the recipient of that information on how to use that information, how legally binding it is or isn't, right? So so a little bit more thought needs to go in when you don't have a human arbiter kind of at the end there. You have to build that intelligence into the process. And if the prompt is too vague, go back again and ask a clarifying question, right? Instead of just trying to generate an answer as best as the model can.
Mm. And maybe we'll throw this one to you, Nick. And then also, Brandon, it'll be interesting to get your thoughts on this one is, think rather than thinking about the place where companies start from, what are the today, you know, what do you think are the most riskiest applications of either conversation or generative AI? What are the most risky areas to deploy it in? What are the risks? And is it advisable to do so? Is there a way of mitigating those risks sufficiently so that you would actually advise clients to consider those kind of use cases? So what, like, first of all, what are, when people talk about mitigating risk, like, what in reality, what are the biggest, riskiest use cases that you can think of right now?
Yeah, that's a good question. Right now, I would say the riskiest use cases hopefully shouldn't be allowed in production. When I say the biggest, really the two biggest risks with generative AI are hallucinations and prompt injection attacks, right? So I would say one of the most risky places you could put generative AI is in a system where the generative AI has access to private data, to banking data, to healthcare data, to some type of personal data that if an attacker got access to that data, it would be detrimental to the company and the customers or patients or what have you of that company. I think the other thing from a hallucination perspective, right, is if you have some sort of response from a generative agent, that creates a bad headline. Right. If what I mean by that is if I ask it something or if I'm just trying to get the AI to say something inappropriate in any way, shape or form, that's a big risk. Because if you're the company who has the headline, you know, such and such AI agent says, you know, insults this person, says this, you know, provocative thing, says this, you know, whatever it may be. Right, this bigoted or racist or whatever that is, that's a horrible direction for a company to take, and that's really just something that we don't want to see in this space, because it's going to make people lose trust in these systems. It's going to make people more afraid to use them, and it's going to make people really say, like, we need to pump the brakes, and this is not okay. I think that this is why Amelia takes the approach that we do, because, you know, one thing that's very core to us is deploying AI in a responsible fashion, right? So we would never, you know, hopefully some of those use cases never pass through a compliance department. However, you know, we would never approach something like that, because what we would do is essentially, as Brandon mentioned earlier, if it's something that is connected to customer facing data, we're going to have a deterministic flow that is not in any way, shape, or form able to interact with the LLM outside of being able to maybe say, you know, okay, the LLM is used for intent recognition to invoke that flow. And then on the way back, we have some piece of information with any PII obfuscated. And then we could say, hey, you know, make this more empathetic to this type of user based on their last response. And then you could have an empathetic response with a payload that's private that the LLM never sees, right? So there are ways to mitigate the risk, but essentially our approach is how can we deploy this in a responsible way that builds trust? Because ultimately, we want to be the trusted advisor and the trusted partner that's going to make sure that the risk in production is zero, right? Or as close to zero as possible. So those are, you know, just kind of a couple of the ways that I see this being deployed in a risky or irresponsible way. And hopefully, you know, we avoid most of that, because I think that would be just bad for the industry as a whole.
Mm. Anything to add to that, Brandon?
I think that's a really good summary. And, you know, when we think about risk, right, sometimes it is just as simple as, does this process need to be done the same way every single time or not, right? And, you know, for whatever reason, I was thinking about it. We just got back from vacation with my family, right? And we had four plane rides that we took, two out and two back. And one of them, the landing was a little rough. there was a lot of wind. And there's a lot of AI and there's a lot of stuff that goes into landing a plane, right? Those are very, very, very evolved models that understand how a plane is approaching. I don't think you'd want to put a generative engine behind that. I think you want to rely on the very specific, very narrow lessons learned over a long time and how that is. Now, could generative help? Sure. And, you know, I'm not saying it wouldn't be appropriate at all, but you know, these are the types of things to think about when you're a company looking at how to apply generative and you're looking at your use cases, right? Do I need this to go the same way every single time? Do I want to add flavor or color to a conversation? Do I want to generate code, which will be reviewed by a human? Do I want to provide an answer on the fly, right? And as you look at these for the use case that you're trying to solve for, I think it becomes pretty apparent pretty quickly which methods you want to use in order to fulfill. And I mentioned earlier Amelia's brain, right? Those 26 different subsystems or so all competing for the right to answer, right? Not only can you isolate those use cases, but you can also put them next to other use cases and you can rely on that arbitration engine to guide the user, even to use the right methodology or the right method to provide that response.
Mm. So it sounds like I'm hearing then that Amelia's general position is when it comes to generative AI, don't put your generative AI models directly in touch with any APIs that could surface any kind of customer or business sensitive data. Anytime that generative AI is going to be creating any code of any description, anything that's going to build a live running application, have a human in front of that so that it's not kind of doing things on its own. You've got somebody there who can step in and quality assure it and things like that. Am I understanding those two things correctly or not?
Yeah, I would love to draw such a fine line, but in the words of my college law professor, right, it depends. And there are scenarios in which you can front very sensitive data with generative AI, but it depends on the audience and it depends on their expectation and understanding of what they're going to be getting, right? And so I think, you know, what I took away from Nick's comments was there are these very generally accepted approaches, right? If you're going to do this, be cautious because here are the potential risks. And I heard Nick say, you got to mitigate those risks, right? What are you putting in place? And then on the other side, you've got a different flavor. Maybe that's more deterministic and you're using Gen AI at the onset. you've mitigated it by having Gen AI writing the code and a human reviewing it. So I think what I hear from Nick is be aware, understand what the innate strengths and weaknesses of generative models are, large language models are, and then ensure that you have the right controls around that in order to include that into your solution.
Mm. And where do you think it's going in the future? I listened to, there was a recent Joe Rogan podcast with Ray Kurzweil on it. I don't know if you saw that. So ex-Google AI professor, very smart guy. The whole conversation itself, if for those of you who've listened to it, is a very muddy conversation that didn't go anywhere quick, to be honest. It was like, it was just a very muddy conversation. But anyway, Ray Kurzweil showed this chart, basically, which demonstrated exponential growth in computing speed. And it showed that since something like 1970 or 1950 or so, there's been something like a 3 million times increase in computing power, something crazy like that. Like, and so the kind of point being is that, you know, from a generative AI standpoint, I know, Brandon, you were saying there that Amelia's been using generative AI since like 2020. So those models have existed for quite a while. I had a lot of companies on the podcast in 2020, 2021 discussing it and what they were calling at the time transformer models, like Gotit AI, yeah, and all that kind of stuff. But then you think about it and you think, right, well, we are kind of still very early in that, you know, in the concept of computing, when we had the dawn of AI in the 50s, and all of a sudden in the last 5 years we've got this like super powerful technology, or at least potentially powerful technology, that is, again, in a matter of speaking, it's kind of in its early days, isn't it? It's in its infancy. The models are only going to get bigger, more data to train the models, or if not getting bigger, they're going to get more finely tuned. And so the kind of conversation about where do these things go is an interesting conversation to have, because, you know, whether you subscribe to the sort of like doomsday scenario, which is that the robots are going to take over, or the more kind of like Nirvana scenario, which is that they're going to offload a load of kind of stuff that we don't like doing and then create capacity for us to do things that we can't even imagine today. It depends where you're sitting. But like from an enterprise perspective, a lot of all your customers are enterprises. They're all thinking of ways in which they can do things better, make things more efficient, you know, not necessarily for the sake of getting rid of the people. I don't think any company on the planet wants to be five people sitting in an office on their own, you know, even if it was a very wealthy, very attractive kind of business. You want to have people around you, and the whole point of businesses, or at least part of the point of businesses, is to provide employment and stuff like that. And so I don't think you can necessarily see where it's going. We can't necessarily see what the jobs are going to be as the future kind of unfolds. I don't think there's any stopping businesses from investing in this technology, because today they all have problems that can be solved by this technology, like too many customers to serve, can't recruit enough people in enough time, you know, bad customer experiences generally across a lot of their channels. But if you think about the fact that we're in the really, really early days, where does this kind of go in the next 10, 15 years? Like, what does the organization of 2035 look like, Brandon and Nick? Maybe we'll start with you, Brandon. We'll go with you after that, Nick.
2035. That is a bold year.
It's far enough out, but it's not so far out that it's kind of like, who knows, you know. Fast forward, think about 10 years ago compared to 10 years from now. Like, what will the enterprise of 2035 look like?
That's right. So first off, great setup. I think we are in a very interesting time where we're not necessarily seeing, or there's questions around, does generative follow Moore's law in terms of that exponential power increase, and CPUs certainly have a lot more time of development behind them than GPUs do. So it'll be interesting to see from a processing horsepower standpoint where we go. But I think there's a couple things that are guaranteed. One, processing power will get better. Two, models, like you say, will get bigger and smaller, more verticalized. There'll be more intelligence built into them in terms of tunability or rails that they ride to avoid certain topics, right? Just embedded into the models. So this model train has left the station. It is going. There will be more models than you or I know what to do with, and that will mean in some cases it's a race towards commoditization on some of the larger models, and in other situations it's really how do you differentiate yourself based on narrower scopes or data sets or whatever the case may be. So you know, my first thought for 2035 is, you know, the average employee will inherently understand prompt engineering. It's not a thing. It's like typing. You know, it's not an advantage today to know how to type well. You are expected to type well. Knowing how to interact with these models and these systems, how to prompt them, how to and what to get out of them, using your voice as the interface rather than the mouse and keyboard, right? That is table stakes. That is what you have. And so there's been lots of talk around, well, what does that do to creativity? Do people even need to know how to write papers anymore or to write a compelling argument, right, with the power of large language models at your fingertips? And I would just simply defer back to every industrial revolution that we've had, right? Technology shifts the job market, makes people more efficient, makes people more effective, and new sets of opportunities and capabilities are opened up to the world based on that. So 10 years from now, there'll be products and services we didn't even think about. There'll be new companies being built purely on generative rails, probably, that access and augment information and provide services to people in net new ways. But I still believe in humanity, and I still believe that the human interaction, the creativity of that humans have to have new business ideas, to create value for each other and for the economy, that will still very much be strong. There's just going to be so much more tools and tooling available in order to take those ideas and to quickly action them and build a company, a department, a process, a capability around them.
Interesting. What do you think, Nick? What does the organization of 2035 look like?
Yeah. So I'd echo a lot of what Brandon said. Some of how I think about this is, first off, I think everybody will be interacting with AI companions. And I say that because I think Copilot has become a bit of a overused word, and AI companion isn't really a defined term yet. So, I think that people have specific AI companions for specific things. I think that everybody who works in some form of knowledge, knowledge working job, if you're in sales, if you're in marketing, if you're in product, if you're in engineering, is going to be augmented by AI if you're to accelerate the pace at which you can do things. I mean, we're seeing the early phases of that with ChatGPT, which still, for all intents and purposes, isn't the best interface. It's just, text in, text out, right? There are better ways that you could, design an actual product than ChatGPT, but it's already shown how much it can accelerate productivity and creativity in human beings. That brings me back to what Brandon said. I absolutely have faith in human beings because what human beings are, what is it that we do? We create things. That's something that no machine has been can do in terms of creating something novel. Human beings have had to tell a machine what to do. Human beings have to give a machine a goal or an intention. Machines inherently don't have an intention or a desire, right? So I think that's something, and maybe there's the singularity or whatever they call it, where AI becomes conscious and is actually able to maybe do that. I don't really believe that that's in the span of the next 10 years by any means. But I think what we're going to see is really a complete boom of human creativity, because we're able to, number one, remove a lot of the mundane and monotonous work, the tedious work. I think that the enterprise has the ability to transform, and we can put our brains towards something else, right? Towards creating a better future. And that is definitely more along the nirvana or optimistic. I'm a natural optimist. So I do believe in this technology. And I think that it's about also, you know, sometimes human beings need the space and time to go be able to create. What do we have in the world today, generally speaking, from a work perspective? You have a bunch of people who, if you have more free time, it's looked at as like, no, work more, work harder. You know, and I think that there's also a future world where if you could get the same level of output, but people don't have to put as many hours into something, but they can spend the other hours thinking about new ways to innovate on and create new tools, new systems, new pieces of software, new pieces of hardware that can have a meaningfully positive impact on humanity. I think that that's a beautiful future to live in. I think that we need to give humans the ability to use our brains, to use our creativity and imagination, and almost get back to a sense of like, what, you know, what is the right way to move forward as a humanity? Because I think that it's going to be combining the technology and the natural desires and intentions that human beings have, so that we can create a hopefully better future. Obviously, there's a path where sometimes people have, you know, nefarious intentions and they don't want to see good things happen. And we need to do our best to protect against things like that from happening.
Yeah, it's interesting. 2045 apparently is the singularity date, if any of you were wondering. So fuck knows what I'll be doing in 2045. But we're at now 2024, right? Yeah, 21 years. And then we'll reach the singularity and then we can all go home. Who knows?
Well, I think it's good that we're spending so much time with large language models and AI now, so that by the time the singularity comes along, we'll be good friends. We'll have preferential treatment.
Exactly. Yeah. Do you remember I was good to you in 2022? Remember that?
gave you so many GPUs.
Yeah. We put you to so many good work. You know, you were doing some really great stuff. If it wasn't for us, you wouldn't even be here. Anyway, Brandon, Nick, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure. Really, really interesting conversation. For those of you tuning in, you can go to amelia.ai, amelia.ai, if you want to find out more. Any specific resources or anything like that you want to point people to, Brandon or Nick, anything in particular?
Gosh, I think that's a great place to start. This is a space that changes so fast that a week from now, a month from now, there'll be another set of resources to point at. But you can certainly reach us on the website, and we'd be more than happy to spend some time with any of your listeners if that would be interesting.
Wicked, wicked. Thank you so much. Thank you both so much. That's been absolutely amazing. And thank you all for tuning in. Don't forget unparsedconf.com as well to get your unparsed tickets. Early birds are going to be extended until the end of March. The agenda might be on the website right now. If you're listening to this midweek after the 19th, it may well be. Get yourself on there, have a look, check it out, and we'll see you in June. Again, Brandon, Nick, thank you so much. Been an absolute pleasure.
Dean, it's been great.
Thank you.